The House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will now come to order, February 17, 2011. Clerk, would you take the roll, please?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Shemansky?
Present.
Johnson?
Here.
Anderson?
Here.
Campion?
Here.
Cornish is in room 5. Grunhagen?
Here.
Hillstrom?
Here.
Fraser?
Here.
Lane is excused. Lesh?
Here.
Liebling? Mazerol?
Here.
Schumacher?
Here.
Tilbury? Vogel?
Here.
Wardlow? We do have a quorum.
Quorum is present, so we'll proceed with the agenda. First item would be the approval of the minutes from the previous meeting, February 10, 2011. They're in the packet. May I have a motion to approve those minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Representative Shemansky moves the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. We'll go right on to our first of two bills, and then we do have the overview at the end by our fiscal analyst on the governor's budget proposal. So, Representative Downey, come forward. We have House File 229 before us, dealing with judges authorizing to prohibit juvenile sex offenders from residing near their victims. The chair would move the bill to get it before the committee. Representative Downey, it'd be our intent to take your presentation, also testimony. Chair will not ask for a vote today. It would be my intent to lay the bill over for taking up at a later time. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I want to thank you for the chance to bring the bill before you here. I know our fiscal deadline is before the policy deadline this year, and I believe this in the end has a zero fiscal note, so I appreciate the chance to put something that in the end is probably a strict policy matter before the committee at this point in time. And I also want to thank Representative Lesh for the chance to have an informational hearing before his committee last year and start to get this discussion started. With that, members, I'll just give a brief description of why I've even offered this bill. This is not an area of my own personal expertise, and thankfully not one where I've ever had any personal experience either. But I do have a family in my district who had a very young daughter who was the victim of what arguably would have been first-degree sexual abuse at the hands of a next-door neighbor, an older boy who was their babysitter, person of trust in their family. And, you know, without going into the details, one can only imagine that set of circumstances and the pain and the challenge for that family and the decisions to be made as they're going through the court process, you know, whether to put their child on the stand, whether to plea bargain from first degree to second degree, and the intense emotional drain that puts on a family, even a physical drain and a financial drain as well, going through that whole process. And in this particular case, the family not really being aware that they could have plea bargained for some kind of physical separation upon completion of the offender's program, plea bargained down to a second degree offense, and lo and behold, after the summer, when the offender was placed back into the home, all of a sudden the full reality of that hit this family, and here they have an elementary school daughter going out to the bus stop, and lo and behold, who's going out to the bus stop right next to her but the person who had abused her. And the person who had abused this young girl, literally their bedroom was 8 feet away from the house, the driveway, the garage of this little girl. And so here this family who's gone through all this pain and tumult, trying to figure out the right way to approach it, with due consideration to the interests of the offender as well, in their plea bargaining process, now has to live with this. And in the end, they were faced with the decision of, do we move our family? And everyone knows what's happened to real estate prices and the cost that would impose on them. And so here they are in a situation, being the innocent victims of a heinous set of acts, And now all of the kind of the outcome, financial outcome, the emotional outcome seems to come right back on them. So this provision is a permissive provision in the statute, which would just point out that in the adjudication of a first or second degree juvenile sexual offense, that the judge may consider a physical separation of 1,000 feet or three city blocks as part of adjudicating that sentence. And so, members, I put that personal situation in front of you, not because we can, you know, always make law just based on an isolated personal circumstance, but I've got to believe this happens all over the place, all the time. And I know it's a sensitive issue. How do you try to return sex offenders into the community? But in this particular case, the fact that the family did not even have awareness of the fact that they could have attempted to put physical separation as part of their as part of the adjudication in the plea bargaining process, they really feel like there was not necessarily a loophole in sentencing, but an opportunity that they weren't even aware of. So putting this in law would give the family and everybody involved in a first or second degree offense situation awareness that physical separation, according to the provisions of this insertion in statute, would give that family an opportunity to plea bargain or adjudicate in a fully informed way. So that's the purpose of the bill. And the background for it and why I'm bringing it as compared to somebody who's a professional in the field. And if I could maybe just have Mr. Diebel just explain briefly where this fits into statute and how it would work. Not being an attorney myself, I want to be careful to make sure we accurately explain that too.
Representative Donnie, we will do that. Also, I want the court to note that we have in the audience Judge Cahill, who is here on hand as a resource witness, to help answer any questions that may arise from the committee. Is not here to testify for or against the measure, but is here as a resource for answering questions. With that, Mr. Diebel, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, this language would apply only to first and second degree criminal sexual conduct. Those are the two most serious criminal sexual conduct offenses. Generally speaking, criminal sexual conduct in the first degree is require sexual penetration with force or there being a large discrepancy in the age of the perpetrator and the victim. The second degree offense is a corollary to the first degree offense, but it involves sexual contact as opposed to penetration. So again, these are the two most serious criminal sexual conduct offenses. They range from one to first degree to fifth degree, and this would only apply to the first two degrees. And specifically within the bill itself, it authorizes the juvenile court to impose a 1,000 foot or three block restriction on the residency of an offender who's still under the jurisdiction of the court so that he can't live near the victim. And it is permissive, but one key provision is that the juvenile court does not need to state in writing why this is in the best interest of the offender, which is generally the perspective of the juvenile court, is to try to reform the offender. In this case, it would put the victim's interests above those of the offender, and the court would not need to justify the decision to impose the 1,000-foot residency restriction.
Representative Downey, is it okay if we go to questions now?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mr.
All right,
Chairman.
Before we do that, is there anyone in the audience who wants who is here today to testify in favor of the bill? Raise your hand. I see no one. Is there anyone here that wants to testify against the bill? Raise your hand. I see one hand. All right. Judge Cahill, why don't you come to the table? And I think we have some questions over here. Representative Hillstrom, then Johnson. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, is there anything in law currently that prohibits judges from doing this right now?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, no, technically not. I think the purpose of the provision is awareness on the part of the victim's family who, in the circumstance, the specific instance I just described, really didn't know that they even had something like that potentially available to them as part of the plea bargaining process. So this is permissive in nature, doesn't grant perhaps anything new, but does provide a level of awareness to victims as they're looking at the plea bargaining process to know the full extent of the options available to them.
Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this wouldn't treat non family different than family, right? So if the perpetrator was actually a brother or a sister within the same household, the judge would have the ability to say, you can't live in the home. You have to live more than 1,000 feet away as well, right?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, yes. And again, the intention here is not to bind the hands of the current judicial process or the adjudicating process or plea bargaining process at all, simply to make sure that family members of the victim have an awareness of the fact that this is an option that they can have at their disposal as part of that process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if the victim and the victim's family, if it's inner family, wants that other child to reside at home, the judge could impose this and say, no, even though you want them to, I'm going to impose this 1,000-foot radius as well, right?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I should defer to the judge here probably, but my understanding is that a family, even today, absent this statute, could request all kinds of things as part of the adjudication process and the plea bargaining process. So this would just be would give them an awareness that this is a possibility if they would so choose. But I don't think there's nothing in this bill, at least it's not my intent to put anything in this bill that would bind the hands either of the victim or the offender or the judge in the adjudicating process. So, but maybe, Mr. Chairman, we should defer to somebody who's in the process as compared to me.
Judge Cahill, you've been referenced twice now by the author. Would you care to chime in?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pete Cahill. I'm the Assistant Chief Judge for the 4th Judicial District. I'm not assigned to juvenile court right now, and so anything I say is based more on general knowledge and prior experience. Generally, this doesn't come up in too often. And usually, the situations where victim and offender, whether it's a criminal sexual conduct case or a domestic case, are often handled more with stay-away orders and no-contact orders, and including domestic abuse no contact orders, as opposed to where people can live or not. And obviously with a juvenile, it can become problematic when you are essentially, if there are no other options, either putting the offender into foster care to comply with an order to reside somewhere else, or perhaps live with a relative, and that might not be possible. So there are a variety of pragmatic concerns, but it is, I think it is, you know, within the court's discretion at this point, under current law, to make appropriate individual orders regarding contact, residence, etc.
Representative Johnson, then Champion. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I'm interested to make sure these kinds of bills get fully vetted. I'm just curious if has the Juvenile Justice Coalition or any of the groups that study juvenile justice issues and make recommendations, have they contacted you or talked to you about this bill at all?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, upon drafting the bill last year, I did reach out to the county attorneys and Mincasa and had quite a series of conversations and exchanges with both of those groups before Representative Lesch having his informational hearing. So the purpose of the hearing last year and the process last year and now this process here is to make sure that it is fully vetted. That particular group, personally, I have not had any contact with them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, any other questions? I'm sorry, Representative Champion, excuse me, go ahead.
I pass, Mr. Chair, because I believe the testifier talked about the no-contact order that's possible currently under law.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Downey, if I'm understanding what you're doing here, you're trying to put something in law that already a judge can already do because you believe that that's going to allow the victim and the victim's family to know what their rights are. And, you know, that's a little bit troubling to me because when you do that, you create unintended consequences. And also, you know, I mean, there's a couple things. One is that you're making an assumption that people know what's in the statute books, which I think is a really not well-supported assumption. I mean, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. More likely, it's when the prosecutor tells them what's available in terms of disposition. So it would seem to me that, you know, this is something that would be better accomplished by some kind of education to prosecutors. You know, this is available, you know, think about it when you're dealing with a juvenile offender. But the second piece about unintended consequences, if you put in law that in a certain situation, you know, the judge has an option, I wonder if that creates a problem where there might be a question if the judge then doesn't have it in other unnamed situations. And I guess I'd like to ask Judge Cahill about that. If it says that in these two situations the judge has an option to make this ruling, does that, if you have a lower offense where you think that that might be appropriate, are you going to think, well, maybe I'm not authorized to do it in these other situations?
Judge Cahill.
Chair and Representative, that is one interpretation that could be placed on it, since it's, and I forget the Latin maxim from law school, that when you express one thing, you are excluding the other. And so by saying you can do it in criminal sexual conduct in the first and second degrees, there might be an implication that you can't on third, fourth, and fifth degrees.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, you know, Representative Downey, I mean, these kinds of bills, I mean, I know that, you know, you're coming here in a good spirit because you want to solve a problem, you know, for somebody. But, you know, I think sometimes when we come in at the state level and interfere in things that are working reasonably well because there was one problem, sometimes we mess it up. And I'm afraid that when you use your statute book as a, you know, to put a sign on the door by means of a statute, that that's what can happen. So, you know, I would urge you to think that through because, you know, sometimes we hear people talking about, you know, how big our statute books are getting. And, you know, I do think that the more complicated and the more exceptions and the more, you know, we've got judges who apparently have the ability to do this if they see the need. I don't know why we want to single it out and tell them so in one particular case.
Mr. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think those are good points, Representative Liebling. What I came to learn through just the discussions that I had last year is that there are there's quite a variation in practice, one court to the other, one region to the other, and so I think the point of putting it into statute would be to make sure that statewide, regardless of the court or the practices of that particular jurisdiction, that people would know this. And I think about the comments about pragmatic concerns and unintended consequences and the fact that the system is working reasonably well right now. I'll take a risk here and make a statement that I was actually really surprised, just as a parent, as a person with two daughters himself, that so much of what we talk about in arbitrating these situations seems to be, I don't want to say bias, maybe too strong a word, but it seems that the leverage is on the part of the offender and not the victim. And here's the circumstance where clearly a victim bears not only the brunt of having been a victim, but a huge financial and familial impact as part of the solution. And so I think the intention here is to just put up an extra guardrail and make sure that victims have opportunities that right now I'm not sure they all feel that they have. And so I think this tendency to favor the offender versus the victim is really troubling to me, just as a parent and an average everyday citizen. And again, I'm not in the business, I'm not a professional, many of you are, so I respect the wisdom and the counsel of this committee and the testifiers who are here, but I think it's an important discussion to have to make sure that, you know, when you're a victim and you feel you don't have any options and you end up in a certain circumstance and realize that maybe you had an option that you didn't even know you had, that's a real problem. And if state law is too blunt an instrument, maybe there's other ways to address this, and I'm open to discussing those. But after all the discussion last year and my understanding of the circumstances, I think this is a pretty reasonable and prudent guardrail to put up just to make sure that we've got some statewide consistency. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Downey. You know, I appreciate that you're coming here to fix a problem, that, you know, that this is a sincere effort on your part, but kind of reminds me of the old saying that if all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. You know, just because we can pass legislation to do something, to tell people they should do something, that doesn't mean we should. I think part of what we do, what we should be doing here, what we often fail to do up here, is restrain ourselves. You know, this is where we get into the, you know, in other contexts, into the micromanaging. You know, just because we can legislate something doesn't mean we should. We're talking here about something judges already can do. We get judges in office. We pay them a lot of money, not by many standards, but certainly by the standards of what we make here, that we pay them the big money, and they have a lot of responsibility, and they're well-educated, well-trained people. And, you know, I think if they're failing to consider an option, I think there are other ways to get that message out, and not by using legislation to do it.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Cahill, perhaps I'll ask you this first question. It's my understanding under 611A.03 that if, and then also for juveniles under 260B, that if a person has been the victim of a crime, that the prosecutor must notify and talk to the victim about a potential plea bargain and get victim input. Isn't that right? And so isn't that an opportunity for a prosecutor in your mind, and I know that you are not practicing juvenile law at this time, but isn't that already a fulfillment of this notion of making sure that a family knows their rights and what they're able to do and also can speak into the process? Can you talk about that a little, or what you think about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, it is my understanding that is exactly what the law says, that the victim has the right for input. They don't have the right to veto plea negotiations. Obviously, that is the prosecutor's right as a member, representing the state and not the victim specifically. But the victim does have the right for input and to object to any negotiations. And I would hope that, and I believe the practice for community corrections, at least in Hennepin County, is that they will seek out the input of the victim for any predisposition report so that a solution can be crafted that is individual to the case. And these very legitimate concerns obviously should be addressed.
Any other questions? All right. We did have a testifier in opposition. Cahill, thank you. If you could stick around a little bit.
And obviously the disclaimer, the court does not take a policy position on this.
I understand. If everybody did what they were supposed to, we wouldn't need courthouses or judges. Thank you for appearing.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and it's always kind of awkward when you're asked, are you in favor or are you opposed to a bill, because we have no position on this bill. But we do have some concerns, and I would just like to briefly express those concerns. Many of them have already been articulated, so I'll try not to to repeat them. I do want to thank Representative Downey. He's had several discussions with us. He has a very serious, legitimate concern. Unfortunately, this is a very tragic situation, and it's unfortunate that an outcome couldn't have been crafted more appropriately for this particular case. As Judge Cahill said, judges already have the option to craft a variety of sentencing dispositions, and one of them certainly would be no contact order. My remarks, by the way, reflect the input that I received from our juvenile prosecutors throughout the state, as well as the discussion by our criminal law committee yesterday afternoon. Sex offenders and the victim, as Representative Hillstrom pointed out, you've got the family where the victim and the perpetrator live in the same home. In those situations, a lot of times they try to craft a situation where the family enters into family therapy, because it typically doesn't just involve the perpetrator or just the victims. So there's a dysfunctional family situation going on. So frequently the outcome will be requiring the family to get into some sort of family therapy. With the child removed from the home, that becomes obviously much more difficult. In addition, these young kids don't have independent living options. It's not like they're just going to check out and move into a condo, you know, a mile or two away. They simply don't have those options. One consideration might be putting, if the legislature is inclined to act in this area, to put some sort of a an age requirement, like maybe 16 or above, possibly. When we're talking 15, 14-year-olds, again, those children don't have independent living situations. In addition, I've heard from some county individuals that this has the potential to increase out-of-home placement costs, the cost for foster care and so forth, that the county would be required to pay if these children are removed from the home. Also, as some of the discussion earlier reflected, the by expressly saying that there are residency restrictions for juveniles, what are we saying about adults? Are we saying that that is not a sentencing option? I think that's an argument that could be made. It's just something to consider, I think, reflect as we move forward. And also, Representative Liebling made the comment about training, and I agree, training for prosecutors, the defense bar, public defenders, and judges is certainly warranted, and I agree with that. Unfortunately, our ability to provide training to our prosecutors throughout the state was severely restricted 2 years ago when the Attorney General removed the grant that our association had been receiving for 30 years to provide training for our prosecutors, and it's been severely restricted. We're coming back online, but it's been a tough hoe on that one. With that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions from the committee? All right, there are none. Thank you. Anyone else wishing to be heard this morning on this bill? Raise your hand. I see none. Return it to the committee for discussion. Again, this would be the chair's intention to lay this bill temporarily on the shelf, if you will. Discussion. Seeing none, Representative Downey, I'm going to table the bill.
Yeah.
And we'll invite you back at a future time shortly and go from there. Excuse me. Strike the word table. I'm laying the bill over. Thank you. We all need keepers. I need one as well.
Thank you, Mr.
Very good. Laying the bill over. All right, the next item on our agenda is House File 440. And I'd ask Representative Szymanski to take the table.
Good morning. The chair would now like to bring House File 440 by Representative Smith before the committee. Representative Smith moves his bill number 440.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And after presentation and any questions, I'd ask the bill be laid over as well. House File 440 was brought by the State Court Administration. It does make changes relating to courts, a number of changes dealing with the following, but not,
Smith,
not limited to, excuse me.
I believe you have an amendment that we need to incorporate into this bill.
Thank you. The A1 amendment makes two changes to get the bill in the order that we wanted. Apparently there was a revised drafting error on page 2, line 15. The word TO2 should be deleted and insert the word BY. Also on page 6, line 28, after the period, insert the language, a surcharge imposed under this paragraph shall be imposed only once per case. That's clarifying language, Mr. Chairman, to clarify the intention that the surcharge required of criminal or traffic offenders is only assessed once per case to avoid any possible redundant or additional surcharge levy or collection. So that's the amendment. I'd ask it to be incorporated into the bill.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Moves the A1 amendment to House File 440. Is there any discussion? Representative Lesh. The amendment.
If I can, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, how does this impact the ongoing discussions for the continuation on Representative Kelly's bill for the driver diversion program. Does that impact this at all?
Okay. Representative Smith?
I'm seeing a head shake.
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask the shaker of the head to identify herself and respond to your question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall with the State Court Administrator's Office, and this is not intended to impact the driver diversion program. We have been working closely with that program. We have regular meetings, and this should not impact them at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor of the amendment to A1, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Then again, on the bill, I'd like to go to Ms. Marshall, but the bill does make changes relating to courts. Some of them are as follows, with regard to vehicle license plates. There's also a provision establishing administrative dismissal process in proof of insurance cases. There's some language dealing with the Parentage Act. There's also some language modifying notary provisions and some language modifying housing court referee provisions. And I defer now, if at your pleasure, to Ms. Marshall to walk us through the bill. And then all we right. do have some testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Smith. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Marshall, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. And I have with me here today Hearing Officer Aaron Williamson, Referee David Piper, and Assistant Chief Judge Cahill, all from the 4th District, who will be taking my place from time to time at the table to explain some of the provisions of this bill. The first section of the bill deals with display of license plates on front bumpers of cars. This is a growing problem that has been seen primarily in Hennepin County, and I ask Hearing Officer Williamson to come up and he'll explain this section of the bill to you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Marshall, and welcome, Mr. Williamson. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Aaron Williamson. I'm a hearing officer in the 4th District, which serves Hennepin County. I'm also a court operations supervisor, so I've been working in kind of the traffic field for the last 4 or 5 years. The issue that we're having currently with display of front license plates is we're just seeing a large volume of tickets where people are displaying their license plate on the dashboard instead of on the actual front bumper of the car. And I'm amazed at the number of people who've actually referenced the statute and don't see that language anywhere having to do with it being specifically on the bumper. And basically we're just having a hard time asking someone to pay a $108 fine when they put their license plate in the dash as opposed to actually on both of the bumpers. So this seems like it would be a fairly simple just clarification in the statute that would make our jobs in the trenches in the court just a little bit easier when we're trying to explain to someone why they should pay $108. Just to give you some figures, in Hennepin County last year we had about 11,000 citations where someone didn't have their front plate displayed. Of those, about 1,500 of them, the plate was actually displayed on the dash. And so a large number of people aren't, you know, just outright paying the fine. They want to come and see a hearing officer, and if the hearing officer isn't able to offer them a settlement that's adequate, then they're actually setting these cases for court. And it's just an already extremely high burdened area of the court. It's just seems like something that might make our jobs a little bit easier. It's probably not going to balance the budget, but might be something that would just, you know, make our jobs a little bit easier just to clarify that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, excuse me if this is sort of a naive question, but what's the problem with displaying it on your dash? I mean, if it's visible and if it's not blocking your vision, I mean, why is that a bad thing?
Mr. Williamson.
I believe it has to do with when law enforcement is trying to identify a vehicle using different purposes, video cameras, for instance. If they have a license plate, or if they have a car driving down the street and they only catch a quick glimpse of the front of that car, it's going to be a lot easier to decipher that plate number if the plate's actually on the front bumper as opposed to in the dash. It's going to be a lot harder to read on a video camera per se. That may be one reason, but I mean, the reality is that law enforcement, particularly in the city of Minneapolis, finds that this is illegal not to have it on the bumper. So perhaps they're not enforcing the law properly. It's hard to say what the intention is from our perspective.
Okay. Any further questions, Representative Liebling? Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Can you tell me the percentage of states that require you to display a front license plate on the front bumper as opposed to the number of states where I can pit my sweet ride and not have to have that sitting out there and I can just have the back one?
Mr. Williamson.
From my experience, I would estimate probably at least 80% of states require two plates. And that's just from my limited experience and seeing people coming to Minnesota with out-of-state plates and being cited, and we've actually had to reference a lot of different state statutes to see which states require. We have kind of a list of all the different states, and just off the top of my head, I would say about 80% probably require two plates.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee for this witness? All right, I'll welcome Ms. Marshall back to the
thank you
table.
The next section of our bill deals with violations for no insurance. Under current law, if you have a violation for no proof of insurance, there's an administrative process in place in Minnesota Statute 169.791, which gives you 10 days to come to court and show that you did have insurance on the day of your violation. If you do show that proof of insurance, then your violation is dismissed. We are seeing a growing number of people being cited for no insurance, and we think that it would be helpful if we could have that same administrative process in place for no insurance violations. And I will give you the example again in Hennepin County. In 2009, they had over 18,000 violations for no insurance, and 46% of them were subsequently dismissed when the person brought in proof of insurance.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually do some of these in my outside job. And so will the court be looking at whether or not the person had insurance at the time that they were stopped, or just that they have insurance now if they're going to administratively dismiss them? Are they going to be confirming that it's on the vehicle, that in fact they were driving versus a insurance policy in their name? And are they going to actually confirm that the insurance is valid and not that the person just bought insurance for one day so that they could prove to the court that they have insurance before they dismiss them?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we are limited in how far, at least now with no proof of insurance, how far into the investigation we go because we do not have a lot of staff that can take the time to look into all of those. I do know that court administrators are instructed to make sure that the insurance was valid at the time of the offense, not at the time when they come in to show their proof.
Mr. Representative
Chair.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's what they're doing currently?
With no proof of insurance, yes.
Okay.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a separate statute that actually is no insurance in your possession. So will you be dismissing those as well? Or based, because there are two ways the officers can cite, no insurance in your possession and no insurance. So will you be doing the dismissals on both of those or just on the no proof of insurance?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, under current law, they do dismissals on no proof of insurance. They can administratively dismiss them. We are only seeking to change the no insurance statute to have an administrative process.
Mr. Representative
Chair.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it is currently an affirmative defense that you had insurance, and so it would make sense that if you're going to dismiss one, that you'd be dismissing others. So as this moves, you might want to think about that.
Thank you.
Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, and we will look into that. The next section we have is Section 3. This has to do with election law, errors and omissions. Under current law, when a petitioner can file an errors and omissions petition with the Supreme Court for statewide elections and with the district court for local elections, and the law provides that the petitioner must serve a copy of the petition on the officer, board, or individual charged with the error, omission, or wrongful act. What the law does not require is that petition notice of that filing be given to other interested people, often the candidates themselves. What happens when one of these petitions is filed with the Supreme Court is that the Supreme Court then issues an order telling the petitioner to file, to give notice to the other interested parties. That does set in some delay. Often these petitions are filed in a very tight timeline. So we just think it would be useful if upfront the petitioners were asked to serve not only on the person who committed the alleged act, but also on interested parties such as the candidates themselves.
All right. Any questions on that subject of this bill? All right. Then we'll move along to the next topic, Ms. Marshall.
Section 4 of the bill deals with predatory offender registration forms. When a person is convicted as a predatory offender, they need to sign a form acknowledging that they must register, and the form also talks about all the things they need to do. In most counties, this form is brought to them to court by a probation officer, and the court instructs them to sign the form, and then it's given to the probation officer. In some courts, the court administrator must dig around and find the information, usually from the probation officer. We would like to have the statute clarified that the probation officer will prepare the form and will have it there for the offender to sign.
All right. And Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what about the instances where someone didn't have to register and then they're now convicted of a new crime, so it brings them under the statute where they have to register, and they don't have a probation officer anymore because they aren't on probation for the incident?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think I'd have to look into that, but I think if they're under a new crime, then it would be a new, wouldn't it be a new cause of action, and they have to register, and the form would be there. As long as they have to register, the form will be there for them to acknowledge.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to take some looking into, because mostly the new crime isn't something that you have to register for, but it's a previous crime that under
triggers
the old statute they didn't have to register before. Now they've now committed a new offense, which causes that old crime to be a register offense. So you're going to have to look into that one.
Right,
we'll
Marshall.
Look into that and get back to you on that one.
Any further questions on that subject? All right. Moving on, Ms. Marshall, to the next topic.
I now would like to ask Referee Piper to join us at the table to explain Sections 5 and 6 of the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Piper. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. My name is David Piper. I'm a family court referee in Hennepin County. I've been a family court referee for about 10 years now, and I was a family court public defender for many years before that. So the purpose of the legislation that we're talking about, specifically repealing the privacy provisions of the Paternity Act, is based on the assumption that it's the shame and the secrecy surrounding the parentage law from 30 years ago are no longer a valid reason to keep the paternity matters private. A second positive point would be that we think the public scrutiny of paternity cases, of the way we handle things now in Hennepin County and all over the state, could lead to improvements of the system. And another possible added benefit, admittedly minimal, would be that would save the taxpayers some money in terms of the staff time that is presently required in Hennepin County now, where the staff have to spend a lot of time screening phone calls from people. In paternity cases, they'll call the family court, and the family court will have to negotiate, well, how do I tell this person about their hearing when the hearing is confidential, or when members of the public call, or when people want copies of paternity orders, they're entitled to the judgment of paternity, but they're not entitled to all the findings, so the staff have to just prepare the judgment and white out everything else or delete everything else. So in essence, we think it's time to it would be beneficial to end the stigma surrounding these parentage cases and open them up to the public.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this make this bill germane for amendments on other kinds of custody matters and parenting matters later on in session?
Well, pretty much everything else is...
Mr. Piper.
Representative Hillstrom and Mr. Chair, the way the law is written now is divorces are open to the public now.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was really to Representative Smith. And basically, does this make your bill a vehicle, potential vehicle bill for custody matters later?
Representative Smith.
Arguably, no.
All right. If I may ask one question, in the proceedings of paternity, is there protection for juvenile situations where we'd have a juvenile parentage?
There could be. You mean where the father is 16 or 17?
Right, correct.
There could be, and I should point out that, unfortunately, we really don't see that many. That would be a very small percentage of cases, and the court always has the option of, if asked, of sealing certain types of paternity files, so that we do that sometimes in divorces, and we could also do that in certain paternity cases, and that those would seem like they would be candidates to possibly be sealed, just like right now we sometimes seal divorce files.
Thank you, Mr. Piper. Any further questions on this topic? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's more of a comment, and I know, Representative Smith, you're just carrying this bill for the court. I know this isn't your... this might be just a fine idea. I don't know. It's the first I've heard about it. But I just hope that as this bill makes its way through, that we'll hear from more of the interested parties, because, again, this is just one of those things that you just want to know what the unintended consequences might be. And so I hope that the public is listening and will, you know, let us know, you know, what the concerns might be. You know, I guess I'll be interested to hear from other members, and especially from Representative Smith, if he has, you know, what his thoughts might be about this particular issue, but also from others, because, again, this isn't something I've given thought to or know much about, but it just strikes me as a pretty big change.
Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, first of all, during the interim, I did a lot of fitful sleeping, taking notes in the middle of the night, and every bill that I've introduced is a full product of my own thought process. So, with a little input from Ms. Marshall and others, of course. Secondly, seriously, I'm requesting, and as chair, I want this bill laid over because it does need additional thought, I think, by all of us as to this particular provision and others. And that's all I'm going to say at this point. We'll be bringing this back after you and all of us, excuse me, have had additional time to think about it. Go forward at that point.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Mr. Piper, would you proceed? Or
anything else?
Nope. That's all.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Calling
then,
Ms. Marshall back to
all right.
Proceed.
Thank you, Representative Smith. We'll ask Ms. Marshall to continue.
Okay, we're up to Section 7 of the bill. This is one of several sections that we have in the bill that we in the court system call our state funding cleanup sections. As some of you are aware, back in July of 2005, all of the trial courts in Minnesota became funded by the state. When that happened, some of the more ministerial acts that the courts performed for counties were left behind, and county offices now do these acts. And from time to time, when we're looking in the statutes, we find references that haven't been cleaned up yet to take the word court administrator out and insert the words county office that now handles this. These are all pretty simple cleanup things that we think makes it easier for the public to know who to contact if they have questions or comments about these things. The first one you will find in Section 7, and that is that the court of... What used to happen is that when they had confessions of judgments for taxes, the county would turn that over to the court administrator. The court administrator would record it, and then they would turn the money back over to the county. Now the court administrator's office is not involved in these matters. So if we strictly follow the law, what is happening now is that the county hands it to the courts hand it back to the county, and then the county does all the recording, which really doesn't make sense. We just want to have the court, that middle process, taken out because it doesn't really happen anymore. Before we get to Section 8, if I could just quickly go to 9 and 10, which are two more state funding cleanups. It'll probably be easy if I just explain those now. 9 and 10, again, are also state funding cleanup sections, and they eliminate the reference to court administrators being responsible for recording notary commissions. These are now done by county offices, not by court administrators. I'm again going to ask Referee Williamson to come up and talk to you about Section 8 of the bill, which is the surcharge.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall and Mr. Williamson. Please return to the chair and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Section 8 is in regard to collection of surcharges in criminal and traffic cases. I guess the easiest example to use would be a speeding ticket. When someone gets a speeding ticket, they pay a $75 surcharge, which goes to the state. And then anything on top of that would be the fine, which goes to the jurisdiction that issued the citation. This is particular in regard to people that enter into cases with a deferred adjudication, or in the language, a diversion program, a continuance without prosecution, continuance for dismissal, or a stay of adjudication. So using the speeding ticket example, someone comes in to get a speeding ticket off of their driving record. They would pay a prosecution cost, for example, $200 is kind of the going rate for a lot of cities in Hennepin County. We'll charge $200, which goes directly to that jurisdiction, and the state doesn't get anything from that. The legislature did order a couple years ago that the courts collect that surcharge on people who successfully complete that diversion program. So what that would mean for the courts is that defendant would pay $200 up front, and then a year later we would say, congratulations, you know, you passed your probation, but now we want $75 more from you. And so we were left to decide, how do we collect this? How are we going to get these people to pay something after their case has been dismissed and closed? So what we're asking here is that you allow court administration to collect that $78 traffic or criminal surcharge at the time that the defendant enters into that continuance agreement, rather than a year later.
All right. Question from Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that would mean currently in some places they don't charge that fee at all. So this would say that they must, right, that judges must institute the $85 surcharge on continuances for dismissal.
Mr. Williamson.
Representative, Mr. Chair. The law did say that the court should collect those surcharges. It didn't specifically say how we should collect those, and so it's kind of been a gray area since the law was passed, not really understanding how we would collect something on a dismissed case. And I mean, the question is, would we be able to suspend someone's license on a dismissed case if they refuse to pay the $75? What legal rights do we have at the court to force them to pay that? And so it was pretty ambiguous, and so that's why we're coming back and asking for clarification on how we should go about doing this.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fine with charging that surcharge and having it be a must instead of a may. But my question then is, why just cases under Chapter 169 and not cases under the DNR statutes or the bad check statutes or any of those additional cases that get these continuances for dismissal?
Mr. Williamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't answer that question for you. I just know that the law as it was passed, I believe 2 years ago, just pertains to 169, Chapter 169.
Any further questions, Representative Hillstrom? Representative Lesh.
Thank you. I'm trying to understand this. The purpose of the Continuance for Dismissal Program, or CWAP, or Stay of Adjudication, what have you, is to cut down on the number of cases that get litigated or go to trial. And so it's a contract between the prosecuting authority
and the defendant. And by virtue of that, it bypasses the normal, you got to go through the criminal process and pay your fee and that kind of thing. And that's kind of the, I thought that was kind of the point. Now would those contracts, because we're talking a lot about contract law in addition to, sort of criminal law, even though criminal law trumps, but with those contracts, now those agreements have to say, here's the agreement, oh, by the way, though, you're not getting the benefit of a $200 bargain, you're getting the benefit of a $275 bargain. Is that correct?
Mr. Williamson.
That is correct. $285, that's right. Okay. Well, thank you. Have you, most folks who are using this are going to be city attorneys. Has the City Attorney Association weighed in on this all, or have there been conversations with them about this and what they think of that?
Mr. Williamson.
To my knowledge, they haven't weighed in on it. Okay. Well,
Representative Lesh, further question?
I'd just be curious as to what they'd have to say, Mr. Chair, that's all.
Representative Lesh.
Before I was doing a lot of these back in the day, and now there are other folks in the office doing them, so maybe they wouldn't care, but I was just curious.
All right, Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, maybe I could give a little bit of history on this issue. 2 years ago, the legislature put this into law. We tried to implement it, and it only applies to the court. So there are many people in city attorneys and counties who are saying already this doesn't apply to them because it says it's cases that go to the court. So if they're pre-court cases, they are saying it doesn't apply to them. But we tried to implement the law, and we ran into a lot of problems with trying to collect money from people at the rear end of the process. We wrote a letter to the legislature last year asking for clarification on how you would like us to implement this law. There was no action taken on it last year, so we decided to come back this year and say, here's one way that would clean it up, and if you want us to be collecting the money, here's one way it could be done.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Marshall, do you have any idea how much new money this is going to generate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no, but we have been asked to do a fiscal note, and we will try to calculate that.
Any further questions? If not, let's proceed through the bill.
Okay, we've already discussed sections 9 and 10, and I think the last big section we have is sections 11 and 12 that deal with referees in housing court, and Assistant Chief Judge Cahill will explain that part.
Welcome back, Judge Cahill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself for the tape and continue this with your testimony.
Again, my name is Pete Cahill, and I am the Assistant Chief Judge for the 4th Judicial District. And as a way of background, Hennepin and Ramsey County have a specialized housing court, which is presided over by referees. And those are the only two counties in the state that have such an arrangement. Obviously, that might change as other counties and other districts, in response to the 2009 law that asked the Supreme Court not to certify a judge or referee vacancy unless we've examined alternatives such as subordinate judicial officers like referees. So it might expand, but at this moment, Hennepin and Ramsey are the only courts that have referees specifically for housing court. The interaction of the housing court statute and the referee statute has led to essentially two different types of systems within the state, two different types of due process. In Hennepin and Ramsey, because we use referees, there is the right to remove a referee and demand a judge, and so you get essentially, and then beyond that, the right to remove a judge with a notice to remove, so you get two notices to remove judicial officers, whereas around the state, since judges are handling those cases, you only have one. You can only have one notice to remove. Similarly, in Hennepin and Ramsey, you have the right to appeal, essentially I would call it more of a mini appeal, from a housing court referee's decision to a district court judge. It is, granted, it is fast and it is cheap because it is no extra cost to the litigant to ask for such an appeal, but it is truly an appeal on the record with transcripts prepared and the judge reviewing it, making findings, and going into all the necessary steps that are part of an appeal. There can then be a second appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals in Hennepin and Ramsey County. Whereas in the rest of the state, because it is a judge making the decision, there is only one appeal, and that is to the Court of Appeals. The intent of Sections 11 and 12 essentially is to remove these two bites at the apple that exist in Hennepin and Ramsey and make, obviously, not just for efficiency's sake, but for equality's sake around the state, that we are all operating under the same level of due process, that Hennepin and Ramsey do not, litigants do not have more steps in the process, don't have two appeals, two rights to remove. The amount of due process that is available for these type of cases should be the same around the state.
Right. Thank you, Judge Cahill. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question about this change in terms of appealing to the Court of Appeals instead. It sounds like it's more consumer-friendly or better for the citizen to be able to appeal to the district courts, is what I'm hearing from your testimony. I know this issue came up with the issue of EAWs, I think, moving from district courts to the Court of Appeals, and there was a lot of consternation around that. Wouldn't that present a similar problem, that it, in fact, the current arrangement is more convenient for citizens, and this would just make it a little bit more difficult to pursue justice?
Judge Cahill.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there are approximately 50 or so judge appeals in Hennepin and Ramsey each year, from my understanding. It's not a large volume of cases, and I think it is equally split between both tenants and landlords. And I understand the concern. Only one of the judge appeals actually resulted in a reversal in Hennepin County, and I believe that was on a technical ground. And the amount of appeals that would go to the Court of Appeals would purely be an estimate if you were to do away with the mini judge appeal. Our best estimate would probably be that it would still be low numbers, still maybe perhaps 20, 30. And at some point we are guessing. So it's not a large volume. It's not used a great deal, but it is disruptive. To be very honest, it's very disruptive when it is used, because it takes a judge out of what their normal rotation is. And given the fact that we are carrying a lot of vacancies to save money, to find the time to do a housing court appeal, it's not enough volume where we can actually devote a judge to just that purpose. And so it does cause a great deal of disruption. I don't know if that answered the question. I'm not sure the ultimate effect.
Representative Johnson.
No further questions right now.
Thank you, Judge Cahill. Please proceed.
I'd stand for questions then, if anybody has any questions. Essentially what these two sections would do is to remove the right to object to a referee. You still have the right to remove a referee, but then you would get another referee, and we have two different referees in our housing court. And the other would remove the appeal to a district court judge, and the appeal would then be to the Court of Appeals. Obviously, it also has the ability to make litigation move more quickly and efficiently by not having extra layers in the process. But most importantly, I think it is the fact that we should have an equal level of due process around the state.
All right. Thank you, Judge Cahill.
Thank you.
Ms. Marshall, if you would return to the table and continue this discussion.
We're almost done. Moving right along, we have sections 13 and 14. They, again, are state funding cleanup statutes and remove reference to court administrators in terms of recording hospital and public assistant liens, as these are done by county government now. Section 15 is a section where we are seeking clarification from you. Court administrators have found the statute, which deals with how we serve notice on dismissals of orders for protection, to be confusing in terms of whether the notice of the dismissal needs to be sent by U.S. mail or personally served. Many of our counties are doing it by U.S. mail. Some are doing it by personal service. We think it would be advantageous if we had a uniform process, and we are suggesting that the service be by U.S. mail. This will save time and save money for all kinds of people. And there have been no problems reported in the counties throughout the state that already are using U.S. mail for this process, and have been for years. Section 16 and 17 have to do with probate documents. Under current law, in civil cases, original files may be destroyed immediately if an approved archival copy of the original is made, We would like to extend this to our probate documents as well. And that's what these two sections do. And then last, we have Section 18, which is the repealer. The first one is 359.061, records of commissions. Again, this is not part of the judicial branch, so we would like to see the statute go away. The next one is 525.091, subdivision 4, which provides that laws dealing with probate court have to be approved by the county board before they go into effect. This is a very, very old law from when the probate court was part of the county, and that we feel that statute is no longer needed. And the last thing we are seeking repeal of is our requirement to produce on a biannual basis a report of all of the wiretaps, pen registers that are sought and are granted throughout the state. This is a statutorily mandated report. It takes approximately 60 hours for a person to put this report together. And what it is a laundry list of all of the wiretap type law enforcement will come to the court and ask if they can have a pen register or a wiretap. Then the court usually grants it. We have to count how many times they come and ask and how many times the court says yes for the preceding 2 years. We feel that this report is somewhat limited in its accuracy because people have to remember to send us these reports. And we also feel that at least in the last 10 years, we've not had one person contact the court administrator's, state court administrator's office for a copy of the report. And in checking with the Legislative Reference Library, there is very, very, very limited need and request to get that report from us. So that's just one of those things that we do out there that would be nice if we didn't have to do. And I'll stand for questions.
Are there further questions for Ms. Marshall? If not, thank you for your testimony on House File 440. And the chair would now like to proceed with other scheduled witnesses. First, we would call Larry McDonough to testify on House File 440.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Chair.
Mr. McDonough, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Larry McDonough. I'm a visiting professor of law at Hamline Law School for this year, teaching in the clinic program. And I've been a landlord-tenant law attorney for about 25 years. Like the commercials, I'm also a former tenant and a former landlord, and I've kind of seen both sides of the equation, practice in housing court quite a bit. I put together some written comments. It's one page double-sided, and I was wondering if I might be able to submit that.
The pages would assist with the documents there.
There you go. Just a little bit of background. I was part of the commission that helped create the housing court law back in, I believe, 1989. And I've served on the advisory bench and bar committee for the Hennepin County Housing Court since then, and was one of the co-drafters of the rules for housing court that include the provisions that we're talking about today. I'm here to support Section 11 of the bill, but also raise concerns about Section 12 relating to practice in housing court. Section 11 essentially removes the right of the assistant chief judge was talking about, kind of two shots at a judicial officer. And I've talked to a lot of attorneys that practice in this area, and most of them think that's a good idea, that you shouldn't get the chance to remove the referee process and then remove a judge and have basically two shots at removal. If you go with Section 11, that puts landlords and tenants in line with other parties, that they can remove a judicial officer, and if that judicial officer is a referee, that might be replaced by another referee or a judge. And that's really the part that in my experience has been more disruptive. I've actually never removed a referee, but I've seen it done in other cases, and a judge has to be pulled in very short notice because these cases statutorily have to go very quickly. Eviction cases have to be heard in 14 days from when they're filed. And rent escrows, other cases have to go pretty fast. So that is pretty hard to find a judge to pull off and get onto this calendar really fast to hear a case, perhaps do a trial that day. And what we've looked at from the statistics in Hennepin County is a very small number of parties kind of remove referees all the time. And for the most part, people are not removing referees and not creating those kinds of obstacles. So again, I support Section 11. I've got concerns about Section 12, and so have the other attorneys I've talked to that practice in this area. That's essentially removing the kind of mini appeal to a judge and replacing it with the larger appeal, more luxurious appeal, perhaps, to the Court of Appeals. And there's concern from the assistant chief judge about having kind of equality around the state. What's really different is that in Hennepin County, there I looked at the records for last year, there are almost 8,500 cases going through the system, and that really dwarfs the number of cases that are going through courts around the state. I used to practice in Little Falls, and you know, there'd be an eviction case through the court system now and then, and they'd move a little slower because there wasn't such a volume that was going through. So we've got good referees doing this, but they're not infallible. I mean, you know, I just kind of did the math, and basically about 15 minutes per case is the average throughout, you know, the year for a referee. That's not much time to figure out what's going on and to apply the law. And for the most part, lawyers aren't there. Some people think lawyers are the problem, but I think a lot of times we help educate judges and referees as to how the law to be applied to a particular case. That doesn't happen much in housing court. So referees, for the most part, are doing it with pro se landlords, pro se tenants, and trying to figure out the best they can. But errors happen. And so judge review is what the process is actually called, this mini appeal, has been around to correct those. But the number of judge reviews are actually quite small. I actually, you might say I've got too much time on my hands, but I went over and looked at all the judge review files from Hennepin County in 2010, and I report those in my memo. There are 33 of them. Only 23 actually proceeded to a judge because the party had not followed the process correctly. So of those 23, the way the process works is they're assigned to a judge who already has a calendar. That you don't find a judge, just grab a judge and put them on the case. The way it happens is there's already a calendar for reviewing conciliation court defaults, where someone didn't go to conciliation court, they want to come back and say, I should have another shot. There's a judge who handles that. It's called a special term calendar. It's done once a week. These judge review cases are just put onto that calendar. So in my experience, I've done a few of these over the years. In my experience, it's one more case that's put on this calendar, usually at the end of the calendar. Takes about maybe 20 minutes of court time. So it does prevent the judge from leaving at that point and going to something else, but it's not like a multi-day trial. And then usually the judge makes a decision from the bench and fills out a form order and checks off a box either saying affirmed or reversed. Sometimes the judge takes it back to his or her chambers. Most often, you know, within about a week or so, does an order that's maybe about 2 to 4 or 5 pages. So, you know, I can't really tell you how much time is going into that, but I'd say it's kind of minimal when you look at all the cases that are going through the court system. I looked at the cases. 6 of the 23 were reversed, some on technical grounds, some not on technical grounds. None of the cases that went through this process advanced to the Court of Appeals. In other words, no one who had lost said, man, I'm going to take another shot at this, go to the Court of Appeals. So when I look at this process, I see it as not a very large time commitment, as opposed to the removing the referee process, which I think does disrupt the system. This one, not a lot of time. It resolves cases that are meant to go pretty fast, pretty quickly, without going to the Court of Appeals. I've practiced in the Court of Appeals. It's pretty common to have a case go anywhere from, you know, 6 months to a year. My experience, they've been more like around 9 months. That's a lot of time to wait for both landlords and tenants to resolve these. And finally, the last comment is most landlords and tenants are pretty modest means. they have to look very carefully at how they're going to spend their money and their time. And litigating in the Court of Appeals is not cheap, and it's not fast. It's a good process, but it's not as consumer-friendly for landlords and tenants as this judge review process. So, you know, we're hoping that you continue with Section 11, but hope that you consider our concerns about Section 12.
Thank you, Mr. McDonough. Any questions for this witness? Hearing none, we'll move on to our next testifier, Mr. Paul Bernberg.
Correct. Thank you.
Please have a seat and introduce yourself for the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Paul Bernberg. I have some written materials that I asked the page.
All right. Would the pages assist us here?
And just the top one is the only one with my business card on it, so maybe Mr. Smithers could have that one. I forgot to put on the materials. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Pages?
Oh, and maybe just one for Mr. Representative. You want the one for this?
All right. While the pages are checking out the handouts, Mr. Bernberg, please proceed.
Thank you. The materials I passed out are five pages, and the last three pages are data, and the first couple pages are typed out notes of what I was planning to say. A little background: HomeLine is a nonprofit tenant advocacy agency. We've been in business since 1992. Some of you I know are familiar with us; some are not. We grew out of a Hennepin County-based agency, and we've now grown to be statewide. So we have a lot of familiarity with Hennepin County especially, but certainly housing matters throughout the state. Our main activity, signature activity, is a tenant hotline. We talk to tenants about their rights and responsibilities and try to guide them through the process to handle matters pro se. Last year, we took 11,695 calls. This makes us, I think, uniquely sensitive to pro se litigants and housing matters in this state. I come here only to speak on Sections 11 and 12. We obviously have no opinion on the others, which are unrelated to landlord-tenant law. And I find myself, and we find ourselves, in a little bit unusual situation in opposing in one regard a bill that's been promoted by the courts, because we generally work well with them, and we just think there's some mistakes here. I want to rate, as to Section 12, what the judge review provision, the removal of that, I do want to reiterate much of what I'm going to say here, and I'm going to say briefly, reiterates what Mr. McDonough said. One, these are high-volume courts, and so it's not surprising you get a few mistakes. I mean, Hennepin hears about somewhat over twice what Ramsey hears, and the next higher court is Dakota, which is half again as large, and then drops down to Anoka, which is at 1,400 cases or so a year. These really are, it's different than the other counties. Second, as pointed out, the number of cases involved is really small. The number of judge reviews in Hennepin was 1/3 of 1% of all the cases, and of those, 1/3 didn't really get prosecuted. So about 0.25% of all the cases end up in judge review, this mini review. There's been a high reversal rate. In the ones that Mr. McDonough looked at from this past year, it was a 26% reversal rate. This issue came up a few years ago, and I looked through the files with the help of the very helpful staff at the Hennepin County Court, and then it was about a 34% reversal rate. This is really high, and I think it's just a relation. It's not that the referees would do it. They're fine people. 1/3 of 1% of the, or even, you know, a tiny percentage of the time they make a mistake. And as Mr. McDonough pointed out, almost all these litigants are pro se. And they're dealing with there's not a lot of money at stake. If, for most of them, if you eliminate judge review, essentially you eliminate review, because the Court of Appeals, as Mr. McDonough says, long, 9 months. Heck, the lease is probably over. It's time-consuming. You almost surely need an attorney. Basically, you eliminate judge review, you eliminate people's chance to have some of these mistakes reversed. And the judge review provides a cost-effective, user-friendly safety valve to deal with this. So I think it'd be, HomeLine is sure there'd be a bad deal to end this process. On the issue of the right to have demand a judge to hear the case, we don't have concerns with that on a practical basis. I think in an open slate, we wouldn't oppose Section 11 on that issue. Our concern is this, and that I've given a couple of cases in my notes, and I'm not going to review them but by name, but there's case law that says that in some cases there's a constitutional right to have a judge hear the case. There was a murder case up in Duluth where both sides were happy to have what amounted to a referee. They called him a judicial officer, hear the case. Guy got convicted, and on appeal they said, well, you can't, for felony crimes you have to have a judge. It's traditionally heard by judges. You can't have a minor, a sub-judge officer. And there's been a more recent civil case saying the same thing, that in a traditional civil case you have to have a judge, or at least a judge, a district court judge involved, like it could be at with this judge review. So the case law suggests that if traditionally, back at the beginning of Minnesota time, these cases were heard by non-judges, that rule doesn't be in, is not in place. It's an open question. Maybe, maybe not, it'd be okay to have the evictions heard without a judge involved at all, a district court judge. The other cases, the housing court here, rent escrow, tenant remedies actions, lockouts, where the tenant's seeking equitable relief to make the landlord do something, money damages, I think there's a real constitutional problem here. It's got to be dealt with, I think, or you could have the unintended consequence of a bunch of cases being reopened. The last comments I want to make are about cost, and because of the cost, that drove most of this three-page set of notes. First, on the issue of the right to get a judge demand, it's a little hard to estimate how much it would cost. Our estimate was, based on the figures we got from our Hennepin County Court, was about $2,700 a year. It's not much money, be a little bit more. Maybe we're off, but even if we're off by a factor of five, what we're talking about is a relatively small saving. A saving, but a relatively small saving. On the issue of the judge review, especially listening to Judge Cahill this morning, we're convinced that this proposal would cost the state money. First, let me comment on one thing, because if somebody, at least some of you, I'm sure, maybe all of you, will very carefully read the materials I passed out, and it will say that of the housing court cases heard at the Court of Appeals in 2010, that there were four of them, one were appealed from Ramsey and one from Hennepin. One from Ramsey and none from Hennepin. That is correct. For the reasons that Mr. McDonald laid out, the cost of handling the judge reviews is relatively small. We used figures from what the chief judge in Hennepin said the cost of a judge and his staff is. Our estimate is $3,108 per year in Hennepin to handle these 33 judge reviews, of which 23 actually were prosecuted. We don't have figures for Ramsey. I just take a proportional amount based on the number of cases they heard. It'd be about $1,352. That's about $4,450 a year. Every Court of Appeals case, you divide the total Court of Appeals budget by the number of cases, is $4,670 in 2010. What that means is if one of these folks who didn't get his chance to use the mini appeal goes up to the Court of Appeals, the state loses $200. Using Judge Cahill's estimate of about 20 of the cases being sent to the Court of Appeals instead of judge review, that'll cost the state about $93,000. So it's a cost-ineffective method. It hurts the little folks who'd like to get their second chance, get an appeal. The history is that they've been satisfied with it. If they're not, as I said, most of them, I think, will just say, well, I can't afford to go into the Court of Appeals. But some will go. And so I think it's bad public policy. We're convinced of it at Homeline. And it's financially, it'll cost the state. It'll save Hennepin a little bit, but it'll cost the state.
Thank you, Mr. Greenberg. Representative Hjelstrom, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually was the chair of the Home Line Board for some time, and at that time they did a study showing suburban courthouses in housing court versus the downtown courthouse and who got the housing cases correct and incorrect in the application of law. You might want to pull that report back out.
You want me to comment on that, Representative?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Mr. Bernberg, we were running short on time. Sure. If we keep our comments.
Yeah, I will. You're correct. We did do that study. Actually, we did another study in this summer in Dakota and in Anoka. You're correct. Generally, the referees who hear these cases on a regular basis, on a percentage basis, do a better job than the judges who hear them infrequently in these high-volume situations. And so the reason why we only have 33 appeals, judge reviews in Hennepin last year out of, you know, about 8,000 or 9,000 cases is because they mostly get them right. And so the judge review is a safety valve for those few cases where one of the parties thought they got it wrong.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bernberg.
Thank you. Thank you, committee members. For
good. Are there any other witnesses wishing to testify for or against this bill? Would you please raise your hand? Would you come forward, sir? And again, I ask you to keep your comments brief and to the point. And introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Stephen Snyder. I'm the chair-elect of the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section. I'm also the chair of the American Bar Association Assisted Reproductive Technology Committee. And I am here to testify as to Sections 5 and 6 of the Act relating to opening the paternity provisions and removing the privacy element of those cases. I'm an attorney. I will keep it short. You can take that with a grain of salt. I'm just kidding here, Mr. Chair. I have some concerns about those sections for the following reasons. Looking backwards, when the paternity provisions were adopted, the legislators had legitimate public policy concerns about keeping those matters private. And it wasn't just paternity. There were other sections of litigation among families that were also kept private. Termination of parental rights, adoptions, and things relating to family formation and family of origin issues involving children and their alleged and presumptive parents. Those public policy reasons were essentially dismissed by saying, we think that the shame and stigma related to those is no longer relevant. I'm not sure there's a study to support that. I'm not sure relevant to whom. To someone who is wrongfully alleged to be a father in a paternity case and is subsequently proven not to be the parent. Shame to the children who may or may not have the litigation involving their parentage made public. I think there is a more complex overview of that that may yield the outcome that the shame and stigma is still relevant today as it was with the legislators that originally passed this. If the shame and stigma is no longer relevant to paternity, then why are we not also moving to remove the confidentiality provisions of termination of parental rights and adoptions? My perspective, working in the field of assisted reproduction, where people are building families in alternative methods through egg donors and sperm donors and surrogates, is that it is the family of origin's choice whether and how to disclose the child's origins and parentage to the child. We defer to that family privacy as a legislative matter. And I think the privacy of paternity matters is consistent with that legislative deferral. We may or may not agree that a set of parents should or should not disclose whether a child is adopted. We may or may not agree if they disclose whether an egg donor, a sperm donor, or a surrogate was used. But those decisions should be left with the family, and I think legislatively usurping the privacy and paternity matters only is a misplaced policy decision. I want to relate it specifically, looking forward, to assisted reproductive technology matters. Those cases have no legislation. Specifically, I'll refer to surrogacy. There has been some legislative consideration of putting some protections and regulations in place, but they have not been successful. So surrogacy matters involving a genetic mother and a genetic father using their sperm and egg with a family member or someone else to gestate the child must be determined in order to establish the parentage of the intended parents as a paternity matter. And I will tell you, working regularly with surrogates and intended parents, they expect those matters. They draft by agreement the confidentiality of those matters, and they do not want those matters made public. So going forward, as there are additional permutations in how families are formed, given the current legislative landscape, I believe that the continued privacy of those matters is good policy.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Any questions for this witness? Hearing none, thank you for your testimony. You. Members, is there any further discussion on this bill? All right, Representative Johnson.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the bill being brought forward, but I do think it is a good idea to take more time to look at it and lay on the table, and appreciate you, Representative Smith, opening up to the public so we can look at these issues and give it some further discussion. So I do think it does need some more review, some of the issues that were brought forth by our testifiers. So thank you for that.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, thanks for the thanks. Clearly, after studying this bill and being its chief author, I see these issues needed the time, and so we will take it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Hearing no further discussion on this bill, House File 440 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for further action at a later time.
One more item. All right, we have approximately 9 minutes left in today's meeting. We're going to go to our last item and cover what we can in that time, Governor's Budget Proposal Overview by our fiscal analyst.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the pages are going to pass it out right now, so I'll wait just a minute to make sure everyone has the spreadsheet in front of them. Okay, I think almost everybody has it, so I'll just kind of generally start. What I included on the spreadsheet, all that's listed on here for the columns, this includes all of the governor's recommendations for all of the items that are under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. And I have three bienniums included on here. So the current biennium that we're in for fiscal years 10 and 11, the biennium that we'll budget for fiscal years 2012 and 13, and then what we often call the tails, which would be fiscal years 2014 and 15. And let me just kind of give you a way of looking at this too. The base budget, or the numbers that the November forecast were based on, that will change just a little bit when the February forecast comes out, I believe February 28th. Those numbers are on here. So, for example, for the Supreme Court, if you look at line 4, the top numbers, so the Supreme Court operations, those are the base budget. And then the changes that the governor is recommending are underneath that, so line 6. So anything in italics is something that is a recommended change. So for the Supreme Court, what the governor recommends doing is giving an increase to help deal with health insurance and pension costs increase. So the first year would be fiscal 12. It's an increase of $94,000. And then fiscal 13, it's an increase of $395,000 going continually from there. The reason that it's a little bit of a smaller increase in fiscal 12 is that my understanding is that those costs don't really kick in at their highest level until fiscal 13. It's like January 1st of the year. So the truer increased cost is the fiscal year 13 increase. Civil legal services underneath that received was held harmless. No increases and no decreases. for that decision item. And so then the total Supreme Court appropriation with the governor's recommendations is on line 17. And then another thing I put on here was just what portion of the court's budget the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the district courts make up. So the Supreme Court, these numbers, it accounts for about 15% of all the court's budgets. So the 2012 and 13 biennium total for the Supreme Courts would be almost $85 million, and that's on line 17. Underneath that, the Court of Appeals. Also, the recommendation from the governor is to give an increase for health insurance and pension costs, the increased cost of doing those things for employees. It's $38,000 in fiscal 12, and then a $160,000 increase each year after that. The total Court of Appeals budget is about 3% of all of those court budgets, and their 2012 and 13 biennium total would be $20.3 million. The district or the trial courts, starting on line 26, the decision items or the changes on line 29, you'll see an item, a line item that says district reimbursements, and that's a transfer out. This is in fiscal year 2011, and it's almost $3 million. What this is reimbursements paid for or paid to the guardian ad litem people. And so it's sort of a technical thing, and it's because the guardian ad litem was instituted and started as a state program in fiscal year 2011, that's kind of why this occurs in under the district court's jurisdiction here, and we shouldn't see that again, but that's a transfer out, and that would show up on a special revenue fund for the guardian ad litems. And then the governor also recommended an increase for the increased cost of health insurance and pensions for the trial courts, and that's $1.2 million in fiscal 12 and $4.8 million each year thereafter. The district courts make up about 82% of the total court's budget, and their biennium total for 12 and 13 is $470 million. The Guardian Ad Litem Board, as I mentioned, their first year as a state program is fiscal 2011, and the governor recommended an increase to deal with higher health insurance and pension costs as well. That's on line 41, and it would be $64,000 in the first year, $265,000 each year after that, for a total biennium budget of about $25 million. And I should have mentioned that these numbers, we always put these in thousands just because it's kind of easier to get the numbers on there. Sorry, I didn't mention that before. Okay, the tax court on line 45, they made a deficiency request for fiscal year 2011. And this was, they spent over, so it was for $38,000, and they overspent their budget in fiscal 10 by about $3,000. And then they feel they have an unmet need of about $35,000. So the deficiency request for fiscal 11 is the sum of those. It's $38,000. And then in order to continually meet their funding for the majority of their budget is for rent and salary obligations. And they feel that they need about $35,000 additional dollars a year. And that is on line 49, and so the governor recommends giving that additional appropriation to the tax courts for a total biennial budget of about $1.6 million. The Uniform Laws Commission on line 53 did not receive any reductions or increases as recommendations from the governor, so their budget would continue to be close to $100,000 per biennium. The Board of Judicial Standards on line 59, they also made a deficiency request to the governor's office. And for the board, they the number of hearings and investigations that they have to do, it fluctuates. And so they had an unusually high number of hearings. And so in order to deal with those, the request for fiscal year 2011 was for an additional $290,000. And in the budget page, you'll see some of the more detail about this, but they say that they would use that, that money would just go to investigations and hearings. And then on line 62, the additional request was for a full funding restoration for investigations and hearings. In the language, there's a line item that it appropriates $125,000 per year four investigations and hearings, and that was reduced. And so in order to get back up to that $125,000, they would need an additional $14,000. So they're currently at 111, I believe is the right number. So the governor approved that request in his budget. And so the total biennial budget for the Judicial Standards Board is about just over $900,000. The Public Defense Board received a 5% increase in funding in the governor's recommendations. So each year, that's about a $3.2 million increase in funds, so that the total budget for the Public Defense Board would be almost $136 million for the biennium. And then the sentencing guidelines was held harmless as well, and so their budget would remain constant at about $1.1 million for the biennium. So the totals, if you'll look down at the very bottom lines, 84 and 85, with the governor's recommendations, the current biennium total for the judiciary area is about $735 million, and that would increase. It would go up to $740 million and then up to $744 million. The way that the current base budget is, based on the November forecast, it's for the current biennium, it's just under $735 million, and it would decrease. So in the 2012 and 13 budget years, it would go down to $727 million and then remain constant at that number. The governor's recommendation for the 2012 and 13 biennium is about a 2% increase over the base. And so that's about it. If anyone has any questions.
All right, members, we will go to questions. Our time is just about at an end. We'll go to Representative Hillstrom, then Greenhagen. But I'd ask you, don't overload the fiscal analyst right now with questions. She will be back because we will begin budget hearings next week. They're going to run a few weeks. Also, your questions, which you should bring, then can best probably be directed to the court, the agency, the commissioner, or the board that's going to present. But for right now, if there are a couple questions, Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to be getting a copy of all of the funds that go in, so not just the governor's recommendation, but so we can look at all the money that went into the judiciary in comparison? What's the base versus what are these recommendations, Mr. Chair?
We will be getting a relatively complete book with everything in it, including what you're requesting, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up question. Mr. Chair, it's my understanding from reading the paper that the governor intended to bring forward whatever the judiciary requested as his budget request. Can I get a confirmation that the budget that we have before us is, in fact, the budget that the judiciary submitted to the governor?
I'm going to go to the fiscal analyst for that one.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, in the budget pages, they included the agency requests along with the governor's requests. So you will see on those pages, for almost all of the areas, it was the same except for the Public Defense Board. They requested like 12 million more, or I'm not sure about the exact numbers, but they requested a substantial amount more than they were given in the governor's recommended budget.
Thank you. Here's one last question, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons why the Public Defense Board is probably having a request is because there's currently an issue pending on whether or not the Supreme Court is going to again renew the legal fee. And so, Mr. Chair, if we could keep abreast as a committee of whether or not that fee is reinstituted, or whether or not we're going to have a large hole in the public defender's budget. That would be helpful.
Very good. Representative Greenhagen, do you have something?
Two quick observations just that I'd throw out for the committee's consideration. One, first one deals with health insurance. The more we subsidize the health insurance premiums for these different departments, the more they stay with benefits, and these are initial observation, benefits that are substantially better than the private sector. Personally, I would not subsidize health insurance premiums at all. It forces people to make the decision on whether to go to higher deductible or pay more out of pocket to maintain their current coverage, which is exactly what's happening in the private sector. Number two, additional pension costs. I think we're all aware the public pension plans are projected to be somewhere between, according to the information I've been given, $12 to $15 billion, a shortfall. In addition, the current assumption of return, I believe, is unrealistic based upon the changing demographics in the state. We need the public sector to start picking up more of the contribution themselves, not subsidizing with state tax dollars. Those are two just observations. I'm open to additional information on that down the road, but I'd ask committee members to give that consideration. Thank you.
Very good. We'll start our hearings next week. There's no further business before this committee at this time. Our next meeting, it will be on Tuesday, February 22 at 8:15, or subject to the call of the chair. Until then, meeting is adjourned.